session number 21735, Reel 2.
Bob Shrimpton, Reel 2. Bob, you were saying that you left school 2 days after war was declared.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of youngsters absconded from school for several reasons. Obviously, they're overexcited. Fathers had probably gone off to war, and they thought, well, we've got to earn some money now. Mother can't cope on her own. So, we did, a lot of us left, before we should have done. I don't think there was any strict regimentation that we shouldn't do this. I think everybody realised that these sort of things have to happen.
And did you anticipate at that time that at some point you might be going into the forces?
I don't think we anticipated, but I think we wish we would. I think that's the general excitement of particular boys. Their fathers had probably gone off, and they wanted to join them, although, because their parents said, oh, it won't last that long, you won't be old enough to go into the forces, you know, so...
And you say your own father had been mobilised with the Territorial
Army.
Well,
he was in the Territorial Army before the war, and then, of course, immediately after the outbreak of war, they were immediately told to report to their regiment, in the Hampshire Regiment, so they had no choice, they just hopped and went.
What employment did you take up?
Oh, I started off as an errand boy for a local grocer's shop, very close by, and they were, of course, in the scouting movement, and that's another link up with them, and so they employed me for a while. And then I got a job in an engineering factory of County Commercial Cars, which were producing all sorts of things for the war effort. They were producing parts for the RAF firefighting lorries. They also were working on a special type of tank designed from a Bren gun carrier. And so I went into an engineering, and of course being interested in motorcycles, so I did have some little engineering knowledge regards handling tools, so I got a job there.
Were you an apprentice as such?
Oh, no such thing as an apprenticeship in that time. I think apprenticeships, when it came to wartime, went by the board to a certain extent, because you never know if you're going to be called up before your apprenticeship finished.
So was the attitude that you would learn on the job? Or you would begin?
You learnt on the job, and you had old hands there were saying, that's not right, you know, get your finger out, you put it over there, and this sort of thing, and I think that was a good grounding for discipline.
Would most of the old hands, would they have been in a reserved occupation? Or would they have
been it was a reserved occupation then. I mean, if I'd have remained there, I would have been in a reserved occupation because it was war work on vital materials.
What kind of hours were you working?
Started at 7:30, probably finished about 6:30 at night.
Was there much overtime?
Yes. I mean, there was overtime if a rush job had to be done. But on top of that, you had to do your fire watch duties on the factory. So, you'd probably have to come in, spend a night there doing fire watch, or all day Saturday or all day Sunday. So,
what would the fire watching duties entail?
Well, basically, it was to watch out if you were attacked by incendiary bombs or a fire broke out in the factory. We had a small room where you could take turns. There were two on at a time. You took turns to have a sleep or have a wander around the works and that sort of thing. But all sorts of strange things would happen, such as one day on a Sunday, an army lorry arrived with a Bren gun carrier on the back of it, and the chap I was on watch with was a little short man. He was almost a dwarf, strong as an ox. And the chaps unloaded this Bren gun carrier into the road, and they said, right, sign here, mate. And he drove off. And I thought, well, what are we going to do with this? It's in the middle of the road. I couldn't drive a Bren gun carrier, nor could Lofty. So anyway, we had a look around. We thought, well, two levers. Well, if you pull this one back, it'll go that way. If you pull this one back, it'll go that way. So we opened the gates and we drove this thing in, tearing up half the road at the time. If you remember, Bren gun carriers had tracks on them. Drove it into the factory. And while I was looking for the brake, we hit a press over a pit, which was used to pushing bearings onto back axles. And this press went canted over so slowly and gracefully. And we thought, oh my lord. So anyway, we hooked a chain on it, and we managed to reverse the Bren gun carrier to pull the press back up into its upright position, and got the brooms and brushed all the broken concrete so it looked perfectly new. And we didn't say a word until 3 or 4 weeks later. The foreman came in with some hierarchy from the War Office to demonstrate how this press worked. It was an enormous thing. And as he pulled the handle on the press to pull down the ram, it slowly canted over so gracefully. And the looks on their face, he said, never like that before, he said. And we got away with it.
So how often would you do your fire watching duties?
Well, you took all your turns. I mean, every member of the staff, the male members, had to do your turns. So it would probably come up probably once or twice a week.
And what was the atmosphere in the factory like? Was everybody pulling together to work for the war effort?
Oh yes, I mean, don't forget, a lot of them, some of the older members, had served in the First World War, and so they worked flat out. There was no skiving off, no such thing as talking about going on a strike for more money or anything like that. And they realised they were in a reserved occupation, and if they stepped out of line, of course they could be whipped straight into the army.
At that time, was it mainly men rather than women at that early stage of the war who were employed in the factory?
Oh, mainly men in the manual side of the factory. Oh, yes, there were no men, no women in the manual side then. They were all in the secretarial staff. My wife worked there, and they did all their work in the secretarial departments.
And was there air raid shelters and that type of thing in the factory?
Well, we didn't have one there. I don't think we had one in the factory, no. I can't remember one anyway. If there was one there, I wouldn't know where it was. But there was a lot of sandbagging and that sort of thing went on, you know. But no, you just probably dived underneath a lathe or something.
So you'd started working at the engineering firm.
Mm.
Can you remember any of the events that occurred between September 39 and Christmas of that year? Did anything happen in the area that was...
No, I don't think there was anything very much, not in that short period of time. I think everybody was probably still gearing themselves up, still all working very hard to see what they could do as regards protecting their property and that sort of thing. I think a majority of that time was probably digging air raid shelters in the back gardens and that sort of thing.
Because we are in the Forney War period. What was people's attitude like to nothing really?
Well, that's
happening.
It, because I don't think they realised everybody was waiting for the big bang sort of thing, and there was nothing going on. And everybody thought, oh, this is all going to fizzle out. Because you've got to realise, in those days, there wasn't the television news media coming through that kept you up to date minute by minute. I mean, what happened at this moment now, you probably wouldn't know for 2 or 3 days. And so everybody was keyed up and waiting. And the other problem was, of course, remember, a lot of the men had gone off and the wives didn't know where they were, didn't know where they got. So it was a strange sort of feeling.
During that period, what were kind of security arrangements like? I'm thinking along the lines of, were road signs removed? Or?
Well, they started to do that. They started to do that, removing the road signs and this sort of thing. And, of course, the old story, you know, that wars have ears and all that sort of thing. Those sort of posters started to come out then, you know. But it was a slow reaction because, as you say, it was a phony sort of feeling. Is there a war? Isn't there going to be a war? Are they coming back? You just didn't know because you didn't have the media input in those days.
And can you remember what your attitude were to people like Hitler and Mussolini at that stage?
Well, I think everybody realised that Hitler was a tyrant. I don't think they knew so much about Mussolini, because he was more like a puppet, really. We weren't really worried too much about the Italian side of the fight that came later as regards the Desert War. I think everybody was focusing themselves on the Hitler movement in Central Europe.
Do you remember the Christmas of 1939-1940? Because I think it was particularly cold, wasn't it?
Yes, it was cold. 1940, I think, was the coldest one. And if you can imagine then, of course, it was a bit tricky because it wasn't easy to get coal through. I mean, coal came down on the main line to Fleet Station. Then it was transported by horse and cart, or bagged up there and brought down by horse and cart. And that's when they started to ration the coal parts of it. But remember, we were rather resourceful then because we lived near the common and we'd go out and find wood on the common. So we kept ourselves warm that way.
And had other forms of rationing started to bite at that stage?
I don't think rationing started to bite too much at that stage, because you remember in those days you were rather frugal in your life. I don't think, what you bought, you made full use of. Nothing was thrown away, not like today. There was no such things as takeaway and that sort of thing. So you had good, solid food, and it was so much homemade food, homemade soups. Everything you bought, you could use. Nowadays, I mean, if you bought a cabbage, you'd take off the eight-sided leaves and just use the heart and throw the rest away. You never did then, because you could make soups out of everything. So I don't think the rationing really bit to that extent.
You mentioned, obviously, your grandmother and your mother still being at home. Did they find it relatively easy to adapt to the rationing side of things?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my other grandmother, on my mother's side, she had always worked all her life, and she was around in the First World War, and so they knew what it was like. And you know, so it washed over their heads. I'm wondering what would happen these days if the same sort of occasion occurred, whether the younger generation could cope. They probably could with the experience of the older generation, but you know, when they've relied on everything, you know, being packaged and frozen and that sort of thing, whether they would actually cope, I'm not so sure.
So we sort of at the winter time of 39-40. About that time, there was the Battle of the River Plate, and with your interest in the Navy,
Oh, yes. I followed that avidly, because the old chap next door, who had been a sailor all his life, he told me all about this thing, and we followed that really, really avidly. And I think I had a great admiration for the Admiral when he was given command to scuttle his ship, that he committed suicide. And I can understand why. He was a dedicated seaman. He wasn't a Nazi or anything like this. He was a dedicated seaman, proud of his ship, and to think he had to deliberately sink her rather than go out and fight to be sunk. I think I could probably understand what went through his mind.
Because at that time, I'm thinking, obviously, with the Phoney War, the Navy was probably the one service that was actively engaged against the Germans.
That's right.
Did people perceive that as happening, that it was the Navy that was in the front line?
I don't... I'm not sure around here, because remember, we're a military area, military connections all over the place. And I think they found that their husbands were in the British Expeditionary Force, and so I think they focused on that part of it. And I don't think it really sunk into them that the Navy was the foremost part.
But you were following the various developments yourself?
Oh, yes, avidly, yeah.
So as we came into 1940, I mean, was the situation still remaining the same?
I can't remember now. I think it was fairly static, but I think things were being geared up with air raid drills, with first aid courses, the old dears doing their Red Cross stunt, you know, going along looking at patients laying in the row with labels on, saying, "Oh, he's got a broken leg. Oh, I don't know anything about broken legs. What's he got? Oh, he's got a bad hand. Oh, we'll do that one." I mean, there was great humour in all these flashbacks, but I think people were gearing up, realising that it was going to get serious.
Did you become involved in any other organisations at the time?
Yes, I was. As I was in the scout movement and knew the area, I was appointed guide to the Home Guard. The factory itself had a Home Guard unit, and my job, if they were going to do an exercise somewhere over in Elvesham Forest or Crondall Woods or somewhere like that, I would have to go and guide them there across country in the dark to show them where to go. So I became involved in that.
Was the scout movement, obviously you were involved in that, was the scout movement used in other areas?
Oh yes. I mean, they helped wardens out, air raid wardens. They did help with fire watch duties during the day. The other one they had to do was fire watch duties over in the Forestry Commission grounds, up on the towers, and that sort of thing. Oh yes, they were used as often as possible.
So around the end of May and June, there was Dunkirk. Was there any evidence of returning troops in this area at all?
Well, yes. I mean, a lot of them came back into Aldershot eventually after they were landed at Dover and places like that. A lot of them came back to be re-kitted out because a lot of them lost their equipment. I don't think there was that despondency that people seem to think there was. I think the old hands used to say, "Well, we come back this time, but we're going back again." I think there was that feeling that it wasn't defeat. It wasn't defeat. It was a setback.
And how did you feel about it yourself?
I think I felt the same way. I thought, well, we're not going to be beaten like this. If we can get that number of men back off those beaches safe and sane, there's no reason why we can't go back again. I don't think I felt defeated at all.
Because Winston Churchill had taken over in May as well.
That was the inspirational part of it, because, you see, when you listen to the sonorous tones of Chamberlain, his voice sounded defeatist. But when Churchill came on, whether he was a good politician or not, I'm not going to pronounce on that. But I tell you what, he was a damn fine war leader, because he had that voice that could inspire people. I mean, whether he believed it or not, whether it was truth or not, we don't know. But he made you believe it. And I think that was the greatest asset. I don't think we could have done it without him, quite honestly.
And did people generally feel that way?
I think they all did. Because they would stop and listen. And his pugnacious face when he stood in a poster, you know, the fish right. I think that was the greatest asset we had.
So from what you're saying, the general feeling in the area wasn't one of despondency or that the Germans...
No way. Whether that's because majority of them were attached to a military background, and they were determined that, you know, that they weren't going to be walked on. I don't know.
Yeah, because I wonder with this, because you mentioned a lot of people had experience in the First World War, so they'd obviously had experience of the kind of the to and fro of war.
That's right. It's quite possible. They'd all had experiences, and so there was always that advice for younger people. I mean, even at what they call War Week days, when that you had to donate, or they had a little procession, and they'd have a naval contingent come through to support a warship, and the local councillors were all up there on their dioceses with their bowler hats and that sort of thing, and they'd all ex-military people, and they were ranting at the crowd, you know, we were going to do this and we're going to do that, stand up to them, and it inspired everybody. It was that inspiration that you got from even those sort of people that retired back in the Boer War, but they were inspiring people.
It's interesting you say that, because you mentioned like the community being very involved.
Mm.
Were there any instances of people who weren't?
There was one round here. I can't quite remember his name. Colonel Boyce. He was a member of the Brown Shirts. And he lived up here in one of the roads in Fleet. And I think it was amazing because he produced a map, which on a piece of paper, and there was all it was just a load of dots. Didn't make it mean anything. But if you laid it over an Ordnance Survey map, it actually marked out all the, because we had a defence line along through here, through Fleet, Aldershot, Crookham. It was a tank trap, and all the blockhouses, all the pillar boxes, were all on that map. And he'd gone round and plotted each one of them.
Was he arrested?
He was interned in the end. Yeah. He was interned. He was harmless enough, but I think probably maybe wasn't a Nazi part. I think he was fascist more than anything, you know. But no, it's just a strange sort of thing.
What was local reaction like to somebody doing that sort of thing?
Oh, I think the old boy said, "Oh, we'll find him, we'll string him up," and all this sort of thing. And other people saying, "Oh, he's a silly old man," you know, and that sort of thing. And I just think they took it in their stride, you know. Mind you, I don't think there was a great deal known about it at the time, but I think the Home Guard spotted it. I think it was the Home Guard that spotted it.
But he was definitely seen, was he seen as an outsider, really, to the general feeling of the community? I think.
Oh, yes, because he wasn't born in Fleet anyway. He'd just come into the area, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
I imagine, obviously, with the number of retired officers that you mentioned in the area, the local defence volunteers and then the Home Guard, would it have been very strong?
It was strong, though, of course, if you've got to remember, a lot of the retired military people, they volunteered to go back into the forces as advisors and that sort of thing, and in war office jobs. But the local defence around here was pretty strong. I mean, Kent Commercial Cars, engineers and all the workers there, they had quite a strong contingent. And, of course, you've got all the farming community around here, so it was pretty strong.
We're sort of talking around the June-July period, because obviously the Battle of Britain started quite soon after this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mind you, being up here, we didn't see a great deal of that. We saw certain aspects of it. I mean, we had a German bomber come down and planted a stick of bombs just over on the common there, because it was being chased by a fighter. And remember, we had the RAE over here, which was then the factory, and they were doing a lot of experimental, so they were trying to aim for that. And they also aimed for the mainline railway, because if you remember, the railway here in Fleet crosses over a pond. So that was a target. So what they did, they drained Fleet Pond. They opened up the sluice gates, and all the pond was drained. There was no water in it, so you couldn't spot it. Interesting factor there. When they drained the pond, where the railway crosses it, it's got two bridges, the Five Arch Bridge and the Seven Arch Bridge, which is now all silted up. But in the mud, on either side, you would find army belt buckles, old rifles, tin hats. Where the troops from the First World War were coming home, they were just flinging it out the window into the pond. And it was all dragged out of the pond. old bits and pieces of army equipment. Yeah, but I mean, we didn't see too much of the actual Battle of Britain round here. The fighters were far more to the east. We did have several fighters round here protecting Farnborough, and we did have one that came along and machine gunned along Fleet Road, causing everybody to duck and dive. But there was nothing much more than that.
Was that a German fighter? Lone fighter.
Mm.
That must have been, although you say everybody ducks and dives, it must have been quite a shock that the Germans would behave in that manner.
Well, I don't necessarily think it was a shock, because our people knew Germans and said, oh, you know, that's the sort of thing they do, and that sort of thing. So I don't think it was that great much of a shock. I think people realise that if there's a war, everybody's involved.
So what was the attitude towards Germans generally?
I don't think anybody had any inbuilt feeling about the Germans. I think people thought they are the enemy. They've overrun France and Poland and all those things. We've got to drive them back. I don't think they had any animosity against... I think they had the animosity against Hitler, not the German people. I mean, I've met German prisoners of war after I came out of the Navy, and they didn't want to go to war. It's the same with the Japanese. I met some Japanese prisoners of war that came aboard the Belfast to help do painting or something. They didn't want to go to war. It's the hierarchy, the fanatics that drove them into it. I mean, they were the same as us. We didn't want to go to war, except we were defending ourselves. We weren't the aggressor.